Hello, everybody. Welcome to Inside Geocaching HQ, our podcast from Seattle. I am Chris Ronan. My username is RockChalk. You might know me from my breaking news reporting on HQ TV. And if that doesn't make sense now, it will in just a few minutes. On this show, we will hear from two of my fellow lackeys. Cindy Potter is back for an update on Virtual Rewards 2.0, as well as news about next year's 20th anniversary celebration, and to talk about our recent blog articles on geocaching etiquette. But first, Brigitte from the marketing department is here to chat about Mystery at the Museum, which begins on July 11th. Here we go. Well, Brigitte, you've been here at HQ for how long now?
2.5 years.
And you avoided the podcast until now.
I did manage to do that. You did
manage. That was impressive. Some people, I think your fellow teammates on the marketing team, Annika and Audrey, they've both been on at least once, each of them, maybe multiple times, and somehow you've managed to just stay on the outskirts.
Is this a new record?
No, there's lots of people that are still hiding in corners and closets. And in fact, Mario just walked by. Mario is one of our engineers.
Yes.
And he came in and asked what was going on. And I said, oh, we're doing the podcast. And he was very interested. And I said, we'll have to get you on here sometime. And he said, oh, no. I couldn't do that.
Well, I'll have to get some tips from him. And now he's avoided it.
I think he avoids it by not me. It's not like I can tell that he's hiding. It's he comes in, he acts interested, and then he just demurs and goes off, you know.
Interesting.
I told him that our French Canadian listeners would be very interested to hear what he has to say as a person of French Canadian background.
Well, you've got a half French Canadian sitting on the other side of the table right now.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, now I don't have to talk to Mario.
He's off the hook.
He's off the hook now. Well, okay, so you've been here for 2.5 years. What kind of things do you do at HQ?
So I'm on the marketing team, and I do product and content marketing, which primarily involves sending the weekly logbook newsletter to premium members and the geocaching monthly newsletter to our free players. And I work with our product teams anytime they have any updates or new features, help communicate those.
So you are in the know.
I like to think so.
Most of the time. Yeah. And people that, even if they haven't heard of you until now, or certainly heard your voice, they do kind of know you, whether they realize it or not. They've read a lot of stuff that you've written and put together.
Yeah, that's true. There's a lot of people who get things that I've written in their inbox every week.
That's a little creepy.
Yeah, it is. When you say it like that.
Okay. Well, today we're talking about Mystery at the Museum, the new summer. What are we calling it? A promotion? A challenge? What's the correct terminology for what we do during the summertime?
We kind of go back and forth between either a summer promotion or like a summer souvenir challenge.
Okay, so one of those things.
Promotion.
Right. Mystery at the Museum. What is it? Give us the scoop on this promotion.
Mystery at the Museum is themed around the biggest jewel heist in history. So we're asking geocachers to go out and act as detectives, search for clues by finding geocaches. And you're trying to recover these stolen gems before you can return them to the museum vault. But, of course, there's a snag because the vault combination was changed by the thieves.
There's always a snag.
There always is. I can't make it too easy. And so the code to the vault has been hidden throughout the campaign. So geocachers will have to discover what that is as they move through the promotion.
You mentioned clues. What are clues?
Clues?
I mean, I'm not a moron. I know what a clue is. What are clues in relation to Mystery at the Museum?
That's a valid question because clues are new to geocaching, and they're essentially a digital artifact that is placed in a geocache. So it's not a physical item like a trackable or swag would be, but when you log certain geocaches, you will acquire a piece or a clue, which is a digital icon that will fill in on the Mystery at the Museum page.
So for people that might be used to, there have been a few times in the past when the leaderboard has been used for these summer promotions. This is a new thing. This is a new way to do it. Leaderboard not involved. We're using this new thing and calling it Clues.
Yes. Yeah. So Leaderboard is not involved this time around. I'm sure it will be back in the future, but Mystery at the Museum has a whole new landing page and all new clues.
Well, it sounds like a big project. When does your team start thinking about what's going to happen during the summer?
Well, we're always trying to dream up what's next, but the main summer planning usually starts at the beginning of the year. That's because we've now had time to see how the past campaigns from the prior year have done, any feedback from the community, and we can start figuring out what's next and how to up-level that. So definitely beginning of the year, and it gets more and more ramped up the closer we get.
So let's go back to last summer. You get to the end of the promotion, which was the Hidden Creatures. What does the team do in terms of looking at how the promotion went and, you know, trying to have some, I'm sure, discussion about, like you said, what went right, what went wrong? What kind of things is the team looking at to determine if a promotion was successful and if the community had a good time with it?
I think the most important feedback is actually anecdotal, coming from the community, whether they're saying it over social media, our blog posts, if they're writing in to us. And then after each promotion, we also send out a survey to those who participated in them to get a feel for, like, was this really challenging for you or too easy or did we get it just right? And then we look at all of that and try and figure out what to do. Again, so for Hidden Creatures, while there's a lot of positive feedback, we asked the community to find a lot of geocaches, and we all know that quantity over quality is not always the best way to do things. So for this year, we tried to even that out with a focus on cache quality.
You talked a little bit about the nuts and bolts of Mystery at the Museum and how it sounds like there's a lot of people that are involved in putting something like this together. Exactly what does that look like when you start putting these pieces in place? How many teams, how many people are we talking about at HQ?
Mystery at the Museum involved almost every team at HQ. It was a big effort. And so it really started off with the community teams, marketing, of course, design, both creative and product design, and our product and engineering teams. We all got in one room, had a big brainstorm of what could we do this summer that would be new and different and exciting, but still true to the heart of geocaching. I mean, we all kind of feel like detectives when we're out there searching for our geocaches, so the theme seemed to resonate well. And then from there, it's figuring out what can we actually build within this time frame of several months. And from there, it's the creative team making all the creative assets for the theme. It's the marketing team writing all of the content. It's the engineering actually building out the pages that you'll see in the app and on the website. So we all start in one room and then it just spreads out from there.
You mentioned that many people at the company are involved in some way or another, but it's not as though people are putting down everything else they're doing and working only on one project. Everybody's got a lot of different stuff to do, and this is just one of those things, right? So it's... I would think it would be, a challenge to try to identify something that is exciting, but also is reasonable in with everything else that folks are trying to do with their jobs.
Absolutely. It's definitely a balance every year trying to figure out something really cool for the summertime, but also all the other responsibilities that we have here. But I think so far we found a pretty good balance.
It's always interesting for me as I look at social media or I look at the emails that come in or look at the blog and listen to people talking about the summer promotion. Inevitably, you'll get some folks that say this was too hard. You'll get some people that say it's too easy, which I think is probably good that you're hearing both of those things because it probably means that you're hitting it right in the middle there. But that's something your team takes into account, right? Is trying to find a way to appeal to as many people as possible, even though it's not necessarily possible to 100% cover everybody.
Yeah, that's right. This is probably one of the more challenging aspects because we want our promotions to be accessible enough for newer players so they feel accomplished when they're moving through the promotion. But we also wanted to have a nod to the geocaches that are more active every day and how can we keep them intrigued and satisfied and challenged. So it's hard to find that place in the middle, but we're hoping, I mean, every time we do a promotion, it's an experiment to see if we're getting closer to that mark.
One of the neat things for me is to see the design work that comes out of the summer promotions, whether it's, you know, Hidden Creatures or 31 Days or anything, and just seeing what will be on the webpage and oftentimes in geocoins and tags and that kind of stuff. Who are the folks that put that together?
Nathan and Roxy get all of the credit for designing all of the promotional assets. They're a great duo that does a lot of the artwork that you'll see throughout the emails and social media. They are the ones that really bring a promotion to life in terms of like how they want the art to feel and like how you feel when you see it and the time period and all the little details. And if there's any like hidden messages in the souvenirs, like they are the ones that are the masterminds behind all of that.
How much direction do you give them when you start working on the design of this stuff? Is it just the title of it, or do you give them more specifics about how the promotion's going to work before they go off and put their creativity to work?
It varies a little bit every time. They're usually in the room when we do our initial brainstorm for a promotion. And from there, they usually have a pretty distinct point of view already that we love. But if it's a little too broad or something, then we'll turn to Pinterest and make a Pinterest board with a bunch of designs that kind of have the aesthetic that we're looking for. And then they'll just take that and run, and everything turns out amazing.
Speaking of creative people, you had a couple of amazing television talents. Award-winning, one might say. I've heard it said, but I don't know. That might be going too far. I might be biased. I don't know. But HQTV.
Yes.
Made its... I don't know if it was its debut. I haven't seen HQTV in action, but maybe it was around before. But it's been a while if it was around before. And Gia Coin, the anchor.
Yes, lead anchor.
Very impressive stuff. And then you had some breaking news that was being reported.
Yeah, well, we can't forget our lead anchor in the field, Chris Ronan, also true talent.
Your words.
Yeah. No, but we couldn't have done it without Gia Coin and our anchor in the field. HQTV was a fun idea that we came up with as a way to kind of give a sneak peek of what Mystery at the Museum might be. In the past, we've led people to a landing page or a blog post that had some teaser information on it, but we wanted to do something different this time. And with the biggest jewel heist in history, it seemed like that would be the sort of stuff that would be breaking news. So we dreamed up this video, and we weren't sure if we would actually be able to get our in-house talent to agree to it, but sure enough, that was an easy yes.
Easy might be a stretch, but it was a yes.
Yes,
that's right.
And then we worked with our community team, who did an awesome job with recording all of the video and sound and editing and laying over all of the assets to create a fun breaking news video.
Okay, so when does Mystery at the Museum get going, and how long does it run for, and where can people get more information?
Yeah, Mystery at the Museum begins on July 11th at noon UTC, and it runs through August 11th. So it's just over 4 weeks long, easy dates to remember. You can find more information at mysteryatthemuseum.com or on our blog or social media channels.
I didn't know we had a website for it, like an actual URL. That's
great. Yeah, fancy this time.
I'm surprised that was available. Mysteryatthemuseum.com.
Me too. Yeah, but we swiped that one up. It was pretty affordable.
Oh, nice work. That's really cool. Easy to remember, too. I'm excited about it.
And then once the promotion gets started, you'll be able to find it in the geocaching app on iOS and Android, and also from the dashboard on geocaching.com.
That was Brigitte from Geocaching HQ's marketing department. Go to mysteryatthemuseum.com for more information. Next up, Cindy Potter, who is HQ's Director of Community. We had her on a recent episode to introduce Virtual Rewards 2.0. She'll have an update on that. We will also talk about the Geocaching 20th Anniversary Celebration, which is scheduled for August 15th, 2020, here in Seattle. And we will touch on the recent geocaching etiquette articles that we shared on the geocaching blog. Well, Cindy, last time we joked about how we only bring you on to talk about virtuals. We're going to talk about virtuals.
Oh, good.
But first, we're going to talk about other stuff. So recently, it was announced that next year there will be a big party here in Seattle, the geocaching 20th anniversary celebration, and we haven't had a chance to talk about it here on our podcast, so let's talk about it. What's happening for people that have been under a rock and haven't heard the big news?
Right. Yeah, well, first off, it's very exciting for us to finally announce it because it's been something we've been wanting to do and to commit to for a while, because the 20th anniversary is a really exciting time period. So as you said, it's the geocaching 20th anniversary celebration. It's going to happen August 15th, 2020 at Seattle Center. And it's going to be similar to what we've hosted before, a block party, but it's actually going to be at a larger venue and hopefully a venue that's really easy for tourists. It'll be really close to hotels and other fun things that are happening downtown.
You mentioned it being like block party. The last block party was in 2015, and there was a lot of consternation about that going away, both here and then in the community. We loved having it. It was a lot of fun. The community loved to come. Maybe recap a little bit for people that weren't around back then, or maybe they've forgotten why it was decided that block party would not happen on an annual basis.
Right. Well, when we had first started it, we hadn't really expected that it was going to be something that happened annually. It sort of just happened.
And it started back in 2010.
Yes. Sorry. It started in 2010 with the Lost and Found celebration. And then we did keep it going for a while, but it got to this point where it was using a lot of staff time and resources. And, you know, generally there were new people that would come for sure, but there were kind of some regulars that would come each year. And we felt like it was probably better for us to be spending staff time on bigger things that the entire community could enjoy, and focusing on mega events and supporting those events that are happening all over the world instead of the one that's just in Seattle. But in the back of our minds, of course, we always knew we wanted to host an event at some point again.
And of course, a big anniversary like this is a great reason to do it. 20 years of geocaching. Next year, there will be a lot of details obviously coming in the months ahead. But one of the things that, as we have now published the cache page, when this runs, we will have published the cache page, that people will notice the cache type for this event. And also, we have a blog post where we're explaining another cache type that will be returning in 2020. Let's talk about that a little bit, because that's kind of exciting.
Sure. So we were looking at the icons that are available on geocaching.com. And of course, there was the Lost and Found event icons before. There was the Groundspeak Lost and Found celebration, and then the Lost and Found event cache type. And both of those were brought out in 2010 to celebrate the anniversary, the 10-year anniversary of geocaching. And I think that it was all done with good intent. You know, we thought, you know, this is great. Let's have a cache type. But we didn't necessarily brand it in a way that made it obvious that it could be used every 10 years. And so we're looking at that and thinking, well, sure, yeah, you could make a new cache type. But why would you make a new cache type and leave this thing that no one can ever get again when its intent was to celebrate an anniversary? So we thought, rather than having dual icons and still having something that is basically extinct, we thought it would be better to rebrand that. The Lost and Found was always a bit confusing, both in English and in other languages, since we mostly find things. We don't normally lose them in geocaching. So we are rebranding the name of the formerly known Groundspeak Lost and Found celebration. It's going to be titled Geocaching HQ Celebration. So that's an icon that we can use every 10 years. And then for the community events, we will be taking the Lost and Found event cache type and changing that to be community celebration events.
So somebody that did attend the big party in 2010, they've got that one next to that in their stats. So if they come next year, it'll be a two.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There'll be a two. And if they attended the community events, you know, maybe they attended only one in the past, or maybe they attended none, because many of them were in the U.S., you know, a few in Europe. But there are many, many players that never had a chance to attend one of those events. So we're hoping that this will feel more inclusive for the whole community and build some excitement about revisiting this kind of concept every 10 years.
And then more information to come about the community event aspect of this whole
thing. We don't have that all sorted out
yet. We don't have a scoop here today for that. So the question that some folks would have, given that those two things are being rebranded and brought back, is there was also the lost and found attribute that is hanging out there that can't be found anymore. Any discussion of bringing that back?
We had a little bit of discussion, but that one we decided not to bring back. We felt like it didn't add any value to the events. And the way it was used in 2010 was actually quite confusing. It was only added to events when lackeys were attended. That was the intent anyway. And that's not something that we felt added a lot of value this go around. So we thought, let's just keep the attribute the way it is and focus our attention on making the events good.
So big party next year in 2020 here in Seattle. More information on that to come. Of course, I'm a planner. I'm already thinking 2025, 2030, what's down the road or what's at least in mind right now for future parties and celebrations?
Yeah, so what we've been talking about is having block parties still. So maybe doing that on the five-year mark. So in 2025, we could consider, instead of the celebration event, we'll keep that for the 10-year marks, you know, 10, 20, 30, and then block party for the five. So that there's still celebrations happening in Seattle, but not every year.
Well, other exciting news recently that we did talk to you about before was the Virtual Rewards 2.0. Can't have you on here without talking about virtual rewards again. So how's it been going so far as the rollout has been happening?
Yeah, well, not as many angry people. But in all honesty, you know, we take that as feedback. And we listened last go around to what the concerns were. And we tried to build a process that felt more fair and transparent. So there really has been a lot of enthusiasm. I think people like that they can see the criteria, and everyone who actually gets one is somebody that actually had physically to press a button to agree to it, like that they wanted it. So it's resulted in far fewer complaints.
Still pretty early in the process. People have a year from when the cash pages were awarded to people to have their cash submitted. So we're still early, but what can you tell people about what's out there so far of what's been published?
Well, it's coming fast. People are publishing fast. So it's only been a couple weeks and we already have 650 published in 52 countries. That is a lot faster than the last go around. So I think what happened with the last go around is there were some people that were very surprised and didn't necessarily want to do a virtual. This time people had some time to think about it, that if they did win, where would they put theirs? And so I think there's been a little bit more lead time for them to come up with their idea so that they could get it published more quickly. So that's really exciting. I noticed that the ones with the highest favorite points right now are in Norway and Denmark, which is fun. I think last go around, Germany went to the top pretty quickly, but this time it's a couple of the Scandinavian countries.
And as you said, generally speaking, people seem pleased with how things are going. And certainly there were a lot of lessons learned from the first go around that have been applied, and they seem to have bore fruit to this point.
Yeah, they have. And there's also a wider geographic distribution this time, and people have noticed that. There's, I think, on average, 22% of the people that applied received them, but in some countries it would be a higher percentage than in others, because there were a lot of people that applied from some countries, a lot of people that qualified, and then in some countries not as many people qualified, but we still wanted to make sure they got plenty of virtuals there. Mm-hmm.
And people have until, what's the date again that people have to finally submit?
June 4th, 2020.
Right.
Yes.
So this will be a developing story, as we say. And I'm kind of thinking of HQTV now in my mind.
Yes, HQTV, you're famous
again. It's a developing story. Yeah. Breaking news. So the other thing we wanted to talk about was geocaching etiquette. We've had a couple of blog posts about this subject. One was about finding and logging geocaches, and the other one about cache ownership. And since I was the author of those articles and I can't interview myself, I thought we'll bounce this topic off of each other a little bit. You were very involved, as was our team, and then the reviewer community. We checked in with the worldwide reviewer community. And so basically the way this started was that Geocaching HQ gets a lot of emails and reviewers get a lot of emails, and we hear out in the community, people ask us, what do you think about fill in the blank? And it might be, what do you think about logging practices? What do you think about throwdowns? What do you think about... And a lot of this stuff is covered in the guidelines, but some of it is covered in a way that you could maybe read it different ways, or you know, you can interpret it different ways. And so we've had guidance that we've given people via email or what have you, but I think as we talked within our team, we thought, wouldn't it be great if we could collect some of the topics that seem most top of mind to people and that we hear about the most and that we really want to get a viewpoint, our viewpoint out there about it, and kind of share what we found to be best practices.
Right.
And not wanting it to be, as I was writing the articles and as we were talking about them during the process, not wanting it to be, oh, there goes HQ again, telling everybody what to do. It wasn't about that. It was about saying, hey, here's what we've found to be, again, best practices. And but still, somehow, even though if it is in the guidelines or if it is best practices, still there being some confusion in various places about these things. And it was an interesting process for us to start with a list of things that we wanted to cover, and then going out to the reviewer community and saying, hey, here's what we've got, what do you all have? And seeing them come up with, because the game's played in different ways, right? And all over the world, and finding what are the biggest concerns in this country versus that country. It was kind of fascinating to me, at least, to see that there was A, a lot of agreement, but then B, there was also a lot of bringing up things that I personally hadn't thought about, or maybe here within the team we hadn't thought about. It was just kind of a fun process, an interesting process, just from that standpoint to me.
Right. I think that the community is passionate about the game, and there are rules that you can't necessarily enforce very easily, but it's still okay for us to say, this is how the game is supposed to work.
Right.
So, you know, is it going to be okay for a cache owner to, you know, track down every single person that logged their cache and tell them they have to take a photo of themselves at the coordinates so that you can double check that they were actually there? No, that's not what we're saying. But we are saying that this is the way it's supposed to work. And being at the coordinates to find the cache, and we actually had to put those words into the guidelines recently. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was because people were confused. And there was kind of this spin we were hearing in the community that HQ says that all you have to do is have your name in the logbook. So we looked at our guidelines and we're like, well, gosh, that's what it says. But no.
Right.
You think they think that's all it is? Oh, my goodness. That's not a game. We're a location-based game. If we're a location-based game, okay, all right, we'll add it in there. You must go to the coordinates and put your name in the logbook. Okay, there, we added it. And so this article kind of helps to highlight things like that where, okay, now that part's in the guidelines, but there are other things that aren't as obvious where it's not in the guidelines, but we're just giving examples of things that really are the way the game is supposed to work.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned being at the coordinates. Group logging is something that we covered in there. That's something that we hear a lot about. We get a lot of emails about that. The people get frustrated when they see logs on their caches where somebody says, I was here with a group. I went and found a lot of caches. Then the rest of my group found a lot too. And boy, between the two of us, we had a really great day.
Right.
And we wanted to point out that, okay, well, look, let's say a group of five people goes out and all five of you spread out and find your own caches and put each other's names on it. At the end of the day, we're not a police force. We're not going to go out and do a handwriting analysis to see if it was really you that signed these logs. So yeah, maybe if your name's in the log, okay, at the end of the day, that's probably it. But we want you to know that that's not the spirit of the way things are supposed to be done. You're supposed to go to each one of those caches right. and not...
No, yeah. exactly. But one thing I did want to point out, just so it's clear, we're not saying that people can't cache together as a team and have right. a team name. Like for that day, you might say, you know, Team Knuckleheads. I don't know why that came to my head.
Because you're with me right
no,
now.
No, because I have teenagers at home, maybe. So we're Team Knuckleheads, which no one would do because it's too long to write. But
TK
for TK. The day. And but you should be staying together and doing your day together, and then just saying in your log, we logged on the paper as team whatever, so that's okay as long as you're really clear what you did together. But splitting up, we do see examples of people like they're literally in different countries on the same day logging caches, so that's just not the way it's supposed to work, and it's pretty hard for us to identify and enforce that kind of stuff. We have in egregious cases, but mostly we want to get the message out that, come on, guys, mm-hmm. let's just be honest and say that's not the way this game is supposed to be set up.
Another thing we hit on was appropriate logging when you can't find a cache. Mm-hmm. We had our recent cache quality survey, and one of the questions we asked was, what steps can geocache finders do to improve cache quality? I was actually a little bit surprised, I guess maybe pleasantly surprised, that the most popular answer was log your DNFs and your needs maintenance and your needs archive
yeah.
when you need to. Because I think in some corners of the game, there is this feeling that, oh no, I shouldn't do that for any number of reasons. It could be you don't want people to know that you couldn't find it, or you're afraid if you log a DNF, it will somehow lead to maybe a reviewer taking action on it or on the cache if it's not right. there. And so it ends up being there's just a bad feeling about using these logs. And we wanted to try to make it clear to people that you shouldn't feel that way, that they serve a really... Well, they serve multiple important purposes, not just one.
Yeah. I also was really surprised by that answer, but in a way, not so surprised, because our community is very passionate and they do understand the game mechanics. And these logs serve a very important purpose. They help the cache owner first mm-hmm. to discover problems early in maybe the life of a cache, if it's there might be a problem. I know I personally, on my caches, if there's a DNF there, I keep an eye on it. Like, it doesn't mean I necessarily run over there right away, but I'll see what's the next log, because there's already an indication there might be something, but mm-hmm. it depends on what information they provide. So as a cache owner, I really appreciate this. If they don't say anything and the cache is in bad condition, that doesn't serve me any good. And then the next finder gets a bad experience. So certainly in the survey that you created about cache quality, it makes sense that the community is saying, if we're going to improve cache quality, we actually have to be honest about the condition of the cache and not feel like we have to pretend the cache was in good condition when it really wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Or use some code
yeah.
to describe
yeah.
it. Another thing we hit on in the blog was preserving the cache experience for other people to enjoy. And we specifically called out not sharing answers to puzzles and virtuals and earth caches and things like that, because you're just kind of ruining what the cache owner's trying to do. And again, mm-hmm. It's almost in a similar way to what we talked about being at the coordinates. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of a part of the game, right? It's
yeah.
just something that you wish you didn't have to say,
right?
But come on, let's not spoil it for everybody,
right?
Right?
Yeah. We've recently taken some actions to try to help make this easier. For example, earth cache owners can now have a photo requirement, and that wasn't possible in the past. So we're hoping that will help make it so that people don't just share the answers online and just get to log it. But yeah, let's go to the core of what we're trying to do here. We're trying to get people outside and experiencing a location and honoring the cache owners that have come up with a creative idea, creative puzzle, a multi-cache, whatever it is, and treating them the way you would want to be treated if you had created a similar experience. Treat them with respect and give them, some feedback about your experience, but do the experience.
Right, exactly. The other So we had one blog post about finding and logging caches, and then we have a second one, which should be out by the time this podcast is published, about cache ownership. Mm-hmm. And again, we can't go through everything here, but just touching on a couple of the things. One of them was don't damage the environment when you put a cache out there. And again, that's something that came up really high in that cache quality survey that we put out there. And it's not just important within the game, but it's really important for how the game is perceived by the muggles of the world. Mm-hmm. And that we want to play nice with everybody and make sure that our game is seen in a really positive light. And it's important to be respectful of the environment when you're, you know, obviously when you're finding caches, but also when you're putting them out there.
Right. Yeah. If we want to have geocaching continue to go on for decades, you know, we have to respect that there are parks and natural areas that we want to preserve, and we don't want to have geo trails all over the place. So as much as possible, trying to find ways to hide caches so that you don't have to go too far from the trail, or there's already a trail that you can use. I was really impressed that ended up being such a high result on the cache quality survey as well. And I think it speaks a lot to our community and the ethics that they carry. You know, they like doing the CETO events to give back, but they also like to have our game be represented with the same values that they carry, which is that they do enjoy nature and they want to keep it for future generations as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing was proper use of the owner maintenance log, which is kind of a personal pet peeve of mine, but just that you use the owner maintenance log every time you do maintenance, and not when you're planning on doing maintenance. Yeah. Sometimes we'll see that people will say, "Oh, you know, there'll be a couple of DNFs or needs maintenance log," and they'll respond with an owner maintenance and say, "Hey, I'm going to get out there in the next month."
Right.
And then it turns out, you know, life gets in the way, and you don't get out there in the next month. And and so just trying to reiterate when to use that owner maintenance log, and to use, because the other thing sometimes that we see is somebody will, you know, they do maintain their cache regularly, but they think, "Oh, well, you know, it's fine. It's, I see it, it's there, everything's good." And they just don't post anything.
Right.
Or they'll post a write note. And that, for reasons of how the website works, it has some drawbacks too. So when you go there, post an owner maintenance log.
Yeah. Yeah. So if somebody's posted a needs maintenance log, the only way to remove that attribute is to post an owner maintenance. So that's why it's such an important log type, but it needs to be used properly. Because if I'm going to go out and find a cache that has a needs maintenance attribute on it, then I'm going to want to know, this might have a problem. I shouldn't count on this one for the day. I probably should have a backup plan if I really want to make sure I find something with my kids or something.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if they've done the owner maintenance, and they state what they actually did in their log, that can be really helpful to know, oh, they replaced the containers. Wow, great. This is a great time to go then, because I know it's going to be in good condition. But yeah, it's a pet peeve of mine as well, too.
As we kind of alluded to earlier, there's some of the stuff that can be enforced, and some of it is just kind of best practice. And that's kind of, that comes to mind when we talk about difficulty terrain ratings and attributes. Mm-hmm. It's something that we often hear from people in the community that will say, "Hey, I found this cache. I really think this is a D or a T4 or a whatever." Yeah. And the CO has it as a 1.5. Mm-hmm. And same thing with attributes. You know, I went and I didn't realize that I was going to have to swim to this cache or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, there's any number of scenarios, but, and it's not always that the CO is, you know, trying to cause a problem or anything.
No.
It's just maybe not being mindful of it. And just kind of a reminder to people there's a reason for that DT was created. There's a reason that attributes were created in the first place. And sometimes we tend to forget that.
Right. And we tell reviewers that they don't need to review for DT or attributes, except for the basic, you know, wheelchair one for attributes. But at the same time, the onus is on the cache owner to just be honest with the community so that they know what to expect from the experience. We don't want to have a beginner, for example, you know, that's never found a cache before, try something that's really tricky and they can't get it open and then it breaks or something. It's like, well, maybe you should have had a higher D rating on that,
right,
because it wasn't something you just walk up to and can figure out how to open. Yeah.
Well,
honesty.
It's going to be interesting to, because I think the spirit of this again was we wanted to kind of hit on some of these topics that we hear about a lot, but then also hopefully it opens a conversation and people engage on these topics and it
right.
gives them something to think about and talk about that maybe they haven't been talking about.
Yeah, I've seen it being shared quite a lot on Facebook in the last few days, so I think it's making the rounds.
That was Cindy Potter, Director of Community at Geocaching HQ. You can read those articles about geocaching etiquette at blog.geocaching.com. If there's a topic you would like us to consider for the podcast, shoot us an email. podcast@geocaching.com is the address. That is podcast@geocaching.com. We would love to hear from you. Until then, from all of us at Geocaching HQ, happy caching.